Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Amy McQuire with Let's Talk.
Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk. First of all, I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations people all across the country. I'd like to acknowledge my elders past and present and the elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to our listeners if you tuned in across the nation via the National Indigenous Radio Service. And if you're listening via our website 989fm.com.au or our podcast a little bit later, welcome to you as well. It's really good to have your company this morning. It's been just under 2 years since 22-year-old Yemaji woman Miss Ju died in a South Hedland watch house after being incarcerated for just over $3,500 of unpaid fines. She died while in horrendous pain in a state of septic shock. It's later emerged that she had septicemia and pneumonia, likely originating from an infection in a broken rib that she'd sustained in a previous incident that had likely spread to her lung. Now, today, the inquest into her death continues. It began in November last year with a lot of the testimony of health professionals who oversaw Miss Ju when she went to the South Hedland Health Campus, not once, not twice, but three times. So this week's inquest reconvened with a number of police witnesses, and we've been following this case on a regular basis since Miss Ju passed away. And I want to give our listeners a little bit of an update towards the proceedings earlier this week. I wanted to start with a reminder of the humanity of this beautiful young woman who had a future ahead of her and who was much loved by her family and friends. This is her grandmother, Auntie Carol Rowe, who looked after her.
My granddaughter was happy-go-lucky kid.
Yeah.
Real bubble and sweet and would help anybody.
But as respected human rights lawyer George Newhouse later tells me in the program, Miss Ju's death was incredibly traumatic, a far cry from the beautiful, bubbly girl described by her grandmother.
The woman that was so obviously in pain and clutching at her ribs is unconscious, unable to move, and dragged like a carcass to a police vehicle where she's dumped in the rear of the vehicle and taken on her final ride to the hospital. Now, everyone watching that CCTV footage understood that these were the last hours of a 22-year-old woman who was in police custody for a fine default.
Yeah. These sort of answers about the circumstances of their loved one's death and who will be held accountable are incredibly important for Miss Ju's family. But it's been a long wait, as her uncle, Sean Harris, tells the program.
Yeah, the waiting and it was very stressing. You know, we wanted it over with in November. We campaigned hard just for justice for Jalika for the inquest, and we did not want it put off into any part. Yeah.
We'll hear from Sean Harris, Miss Ju's uncle, and George Newhouse, who is assisting Death in Custody Watch WA at the inquest and has a long celebrated history as a human rights lawyer later on in the program. First, I want to start with an interview with The Guardian's WA correspondent, Carla Walkhurst, who's been at the inquest every day and is telling me a little bit about the facts that have already come out in the case. You've been attending the inquest pretty much the whole time. Can I first ask you about the timeline of Miss Ju's death? When did she enter custody? How many visits did she make to the health campus, and what time did she actually pass away?
Yeah, look, Miss Ju was arrested alongside her partner, Dion Ruffin, around 5 o'clock on August the 2nd, 2014. She was then taken to hospital for the first time around 9 o'clock on the night of August the 2nd, after waiting for about 90 minutes for some police to be free to take her to the hospital. She'd first reported feeling, you know, in pain at about 6:30, and then that had steadily got worse and she'd begun crying in pain. So she was waiting for about 90 minutes to go to the hospital on the first night. Then on August the 3rd, she made another complaint of pain that she said that the pain that had begun sort of on the right side, concentrated around an old broken rib, was now radiating out, and she had pain all over her body. And so she was taken to hospital again at about 6 p.m. the next night. And then she was returned again. That hospital visit took a really long time. They were away for about 90 minutes. And then on the morning of August the 4th, she woke up and said that she couldn't feel her legs. That became worse. She eventually got to the point where she couldn't sit up. She asked to go to hospital a number of times through the morning, and the decision was made to send her to hospital about midday. She eventually left in the police van to go to hospital, which was about a minute away, at 12:39 p.m. on August the 4th. She was diagnosed as having gone into cardiac arrest pretty much the minute the first nurse saw her at the hospital on that day, and she was declared dead an hour later.
And what was the reason why? How did police or police officers at the coronial inquest, how have they described her pain? Did they believe her pain at the time? What has been the evidence from arresting officers?
Look, the evidence from all the officers that we've heard so far, and we've heard 10 police officers who had some involvement with Miss Jew so far, have given evidence in the first 3 days of this week, has been that they all genuinely believed she had pain. That's what they've all said on the stand. They've all said that they genuinely believed she had pain. Some people have said that they thought that possibly she genuinely had pain, but she had a low threshold for pain, or she may have been exaggerating her symptoms. And that seems to be a belief that occurred after the hospital visits, because the hospital staff gave her quite a strong painkiller on the first visit, although police seemed to believe that she was only given Panadol on that first visit. And on the second visit to the hospital, she was just given Panadol. And it seemed that a lot of police officers, after she was returned from the hospital with just Panadol, believed that she mustn't have been in real pain. There was actually a comment from one of the police officers which was caught on the CCTV from the police station, where he said paracetamol after all that, which he said in court was an expression of him showing disbelief in the fact that that has been all it was. And he said that after that point, he believed that Miss Jew may have been exaggerating her pain. So everyone on the stand has said that they genuinely believed she had pain. That doesn't necessarily accord with what some police officers said they heard other police officers say, although at this stage, no police have been able to say on the stand under oath who they heard at the station suggesting that she may have been faking it or exaggerating, yeah, or who they heard at the station suggesting that it may have been drug withdrawals. But they're all suggestions that were very much in the air at the station that no one's been prepared to name and say where they've come from. And certainly the doctors on, I think, all three visits gave evidence last year that they heard suggestions from police that there was a belief that she may have been exaggerating or faking it. But
so we don't know where it originated, whether it originated from the health professionals or the police themselves.
No, look, the evidence from the health professionals is that it originated from the police. The evidence from the police is that it originated from the health professionals. Police now, when they're asked to say where they first heard that suggestion, have said that they can't recall where they heard the suggestion that she may have been faking it. We heard one police officer yesterday, that was a person who was then an acting sergeant Russell Tyndall, said that he overheard and was involved in discussions about the suggestion that there was a belief Miss Jew was exaggerating her symptoms because she was going through drug withdrawal. And he said he was involved in those discussions, which were big groups, 10 or 12 officers, in the days after she died.
Wow, so that's pretty significant that there were quite widespread discussions that he's said he's seen or undertaken.
Yeah, the impression is there was clearly that belief or that conversation going around the station, but it hasn't been attributed to any particular officer at this stage.
That's very interesting. And there was another officer, actually one of the arresting officers that you've reported about, First Class Constable Vicky Eastman, who actually told the inquest that throughout Miss Jew's incarceration, she appeared worse or a lot worse, and one of the nurses actually told her she believed she was coming down from drugs. So that was another piece of evidence that was actually given at the inquest.
Yeah, look, First Class Constable Vicky Eastman was one of the police officers who arrested Miss Jew on August the 2nd, so she saw her on the first day. She said at the time she was walking a bit carefully, and she was also the first person that was told by Miss Jew that she had this old broken rib injury and that she had a broken toe and a blister on her toe. She was also the first person who was told by Miss Dew that she didn't need to go to hospital. When Miss Dew was first arrested, she declined an offer to go to hospital. She said she was probably fine, and then she worsened in the evening. She told the court yesterday that when she took Miss Dew to hospital on August the 3rd, so around 24 hours after her arrest, that Miss Dew was a lot worse. She seemed to be a lot worse. She thought that she was in genuine pain. She said that, you know, she was crying out in the hospital, and the words she used were that she couldn't contain it. Miss Dew wasn't trying to be loud. She was trying to be quiet, but she couldn't contain it. She also made the point that Miss Dew was very polite and respectful when arrested, and remained polite and respectful even when she was in quite a lot of pain, which is an important point because there was a suggestion from medical witnesses who gave evidence last year that Miss Dew was possibly being disruptive at the hospital, and there was an original diagnosis of behavioural issues. So the fact that the arresting police officer said that she remained polite and respectful is a relevant factor. But yeah, she said that she thought Miss Dew was a lot worse, but she also said there was a comment from the triage nurse, which the triage nurse last year when she gave evidence confirmed that she made, that possibly Miss Dew's symptoms of dehydration and tachycardia, so an increased heart rate, was could be linked to drug withdrawal. And because Miss Dew had said that she was an intravenous methamphetamine user, she used about once a fortnight, she used maybe, I think it was half a point once a fortnight, there was a suggestion that it could be something to do with drug withdrawal.
And she was actually pressed on that sentiment, wasn't it, in your article, and basically asked whether she thought that severe withdrawal, severe pain could be attributed to that sort of withdrawal.
Look, she was. The counsel assisting the coroner, a man called Philip Urquhart, pushed on that. He said, don't you think that that would be a very sort of extreme reaction, given what was a fairly low level of drug use? And First Class Counsel Eastman's response was that she didn't have a lot of experience with drug withdrawal and she wouldn't be able to comment on that.
How many officers would you say have said they can't recall very significant details? Has it been sort of a continual statement on behalf of...
Pretty much everyone.
Yeah.
Pretty much everyone has said that. And that's significant mainly because this was, you know, it was almost 2 years ago. It was August 2014 that this occurred. But on a West Australian timeline, this is actually a relatively fast, expedited inquest. You know, the Premier got involved and said that it was going to happen more regularly. We've had other inquests, like the death in custody of Miss Mandijarra. She died on the 30th of November 2012, and the first part of that inquest was only in February this year. Another death in custody for a young man called Jaden Bunnell. He died in May 2013. That inquest isn't scheduled until September of this year. So a lot of people have said they can't recall because it was some time ago, and that is correct, it was some time ago. But it's concerning just because most inquests take even longer than this.
Yeah.
And so there is a thought from people who attend a lot of inquests that this is really worrying. Like, if people can't recall on this sort of timescale, which is faster than the normal timescale, what's going to happen at those other inquests?
And does it suggest that evidence or testimony wasn't properly recorded at the time? Has that been as well?
Most, all of the police officers involved undertook an interview with WA Police Internal Affairs. Most of those were within days. And they have at all point, you know, the transcript of those interviews is referred to in their examination in chief and cross-examination in the inquest. And all of the police officers have said, look, if something that I say now is inconsistent with something I said in that earlier interview, rely on that earlier interview. It was, you know, that was when the memories were fresher in my mind. So when there is an inconsistency between what they're saying now and what they're saying then, they're relying on their previous evidence, their more recent evidence. So that was all fully recorded. But it's very frustrating for the family, particularly given that this inquest had to be part heard. It was intended that it would be finished last year and then it ran over time. Mm. The family was really concerned that there would be an increase in the number of people saying that they don't recall. I'm not sure that we would have got different responses had these interviews been conducted in November as opposed to now, but it's very distressing for the family to hear all these people say that they don't recall these details.
And I was going to ask you, as someone who's been at this inquest for, you know, since it began, what has sort of been like the feeling that you felt going to the inquest every day? What's the feeling coming from the family from your perspective and from the police from your perspective?
Look, it's a very difficult situation for the family. You know, Miss Dew's grandmother, Carol, has been there every day. Her mother, Della, has not been able to be there every day. It's become a bit overwhelming for her at some points. You know, you've had Auntie Carol getting up and having to walk out every single time Miss Dew's image is on the screen because the CCTV continues to be played and it's quite distressing. You can hear Miss Dew crying in a lot of the CCTV. And to hear the responses from police officers, even when they're, you know, they're fulfilling their duty, they're saying whether they can recall or whether they can't recall. But sometimes the unemotional way that police officers are responding, which is just a product of their training, I'm not intending that as a criticism of them, that's very difficult for the family to hear. And the police officers themselves, there's been a range of different reactions from them. I think that the overwhelming sentiment from police officers has been that they had a fitness to hold Miss Dew in custody and they thought they were right to rely on that. That they, even if they had other concerns about her condition or they were surprised that she was declared fit to hold or surprised that she wasn't given other treatment, they placed ultimate faith in the medical practitioners and they believed that they were right to be able to hold her in custody. There were a few that were more distressed than others. There was one in particular, Constable Carrie Sharples, who actually sat with Miss Dew for 90 minutes on the first day, and she broke down and cried, and she genuinely seemed very distressed at the sort of way that Miss Dew was carried from her cell. She seemed very distressed at the way everything had gone on. But most of the police officers, while they seem, you know, distressed that this happened, believed that they were correct in agreeing with medical advice. And from the medical witnesses last year, we heard that they believed that what their diagnosis was correct with the information that was in front of them. They didn't necessarily have a full account from police officers about, you know, the state of Miss Dew's deterioration. They didn't know her as a person. And the comments last year from medical witnesses were, look, I made that judgment call based on the information in front of me.
Has there been any suggestion about race and the Aboriginality of Miss Dew raised in the inquest so far?
There has, mainly by expert witnesses. So there have been expert witnesses who were called last year who gave evidence about the treatment of Aboriginal people in the health system and gave evidence about systemic and institutionalised racism in the health system and in police, and also in the stigma that comes of going into the emergency room in handcuffs or being escorted with police, because emergency departments would frequently see prisoners being escorted in by police. It's not uncommon for prisoners in that situation, the inquest has heard, to exaggerate their symptoms or to maybe, you know, ask for medical assistance when it's not for a relatively minor issue. And so there is that prejudice that's in the back of people's minds. But all the witnesses who were directly involved in this case have denied that structural or institutionalised racism played any role in it. Today we're actually going to, so today being Thursday, we're actually going to hear from the Aboriginal Liaison Officer from South Hedland Police Station, and I imagine she will be asked to give evidence on this vein as well.
That was Carla Walkhurst, the Guardian Australian's Western Australia correspondent, who's been following the inquest of Miss Dew from the very start. We'll take a break now and we'll come back more with my interview with Sean Harris, the uncle of Miss Dew, and George Newhouse, who is assisting the Death in Custody Watch WA at the inquest, which continues this week and will likely continue over next week as well.
You're listening to Let's Talk with Amy McQuire on 98.9 FM.
That was Is This What We Deserve by Kutcher Edwards. And you really have to ask, is this what we deserve? Earlier, we're talking about the death in custody of Ms. Dew, a 22-year-old Yamaji woman who died in a Port Hedland watch house 2 years ago, or just over 1 year ago now, not yet two. We spoke to Carla Walkhurst, who's covering the inquest, which is currently undergoing in Perth for The Guardian. Now, I also spoke to George Newhouse, who is a human rights lawyer with a long history, in particularly in Aboriginal affairs, who's actually assisting the Death in Custody Watch WA at the inquest. I spoke to him earlier this week. First question I was going to ask you, just from a general point of view, as sort of a respected human rights lawyer, the fact that this inquest is going on at the moment and barely anyone's really talking about it, I mean, it's not creating headlines anywhere. Does that shock you, given your background in these sort of cases?
It does surprise me that this case is not more notorious. The circumstances of Ms. Du's tragic death are shocking, and the pain and suffering that she went through in the lead up to her death are gut-wrenching. It is a case that should disturb all Australians, and the family, quite rightly, want to ensure that this never happens again to any Australian.
You say you're surprised. I mean, why do you think this case particularly hasn't created that uproar? Is it because she's, I guess, a young Aboriginal woman? Do you think that plays into it?
No, I don't. I think one of the main reasons is we live in a visual society, and the imagery of her death, which was filmed on video cameras, has not been released to the public. I think the shocking images that have caused trauma, I think, to many of the people inside the inquest have not been released publicly. Yeah. And as a result, the public aren't truly aware of the horrors of what happened to Ms. Du.
I mean, you've seen that CCTV footage, and obviously the family were quite traumatised by it. How would you describe what was shown in that footage? It shows her quite obvious pain, didn't it?
I find it difficult to recall myself. It's an incredibly traumatic piece of vision. A woman that was so obviously in pain and clutching at her ribs is unconscious, unable to move, and dragged like a carcass to a police vehicle where she's dumped in the rear of the vehicle and taken on her final ride to the hospital. Now, everyone watching that CCTV footage understood that these were the last hours of a 22-year-old woman who was in police custody for a finder fault.
Yeah.
And those last moments must have been some of the most horrific in that short life.
But leading up to that, I mean, she had told police that she had a broken rib, that she was in pain, but she was never believed, even from, there was 11 officers in that duty of command. I mean, what was their explanation looking at this week's inquest? Was there any explanation given for not believing her cries of pain?
I can't form conclusions about what happened that night because that is a matter for the coroner. But evidence was given over this week that some police officers did believe Ms. Du's pain was real.
Yeah.
Some were then influenced by what doctors or nurses had told them or had how doctors or nurses had reacted to Ms. Du's pain. It's a complex situation where there was a negative feedback loop between police officers, medical practitioners, nurses, other clinicians, and a failure to pass on information from one to the other. It's a combination of those factors, I think, that led to Ms. Du's tragic situation.
Do you think race played a role in her treatment and which ultimately led to her death?
Look, I'm just an observer, and ultimately these are matters for the coroner to decide. But there is a common theme from the evidence about assumptions being made about someone. And you can't help but thinking that assumptions were made about Ms. Du and her behaviour because of her Aboriginality.
I noticed just in the media reporting there seems to be a lot of cases where police can't recall or they have no independent recollection of the events. I mean, is that common in your view or is it acceptable, do you think?
I'm not going to comment on that evidence specifically, but I will say that this highlights the problem of having coronial inquests years after a death.
What would you expect to come out of this inquest? What sort of options do you hope, I guess, the coroner could consider?
The coroner has a statutory duty to find a cause of death, but also comment on Ms. Du's treatment and care in the lead up to her death. And I think those are going to be the most interesting findings of the coroner.
You mentioned before that there seems to be a failure in communication and a lot of a really complex reason why Miss Dew wasn't believed between health professionals and law officers. A lot of that has been, you know, recommended before, particularly in the Royal Commission. I mean, these problems have come up continually. Should they have been fixed by now, these sort of police procedures and the things that ultimately looked like they led to Miss Dew's death?
It's hard to understand over 25 years after the Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody, how there aren't sufficient roadblocks in people's thinking and assumptions to ensure the safety of a vulnerable 22-year-old woman in police custody in Western Australia.
That was human rights lawyer George Newhouse speaking about the death in custody of Miss Dew, and the inquest continues into the next week. We'll be back after the break. Here's Archie Roach, Heal the People.
This is Let's Talk with Amy McQuire.
You're listening to Let's Talk, and today we're talking about the death in custody of Miss Chu, a 22-year-old Yamaji woman who died nearly 2 years ago in a South Hedland watch house. I spoke to her uncle, Sean Harris, earlier this week, and he's been attending the inquest almost every day. How was it waiting over the Christmas period for this inquest to continue? Because I know there was a bit of a delay.
Very stressing. You know, we wanted it over with in November. We campaigned hard just for justice for Jalika for the inquest, and we did not want it put off into any part. Second part or even a third, maybe. Who knows? And the fact that it got put off in November and Jalika's birthday was actually on Boxing Day is a big reason why we wanted to get all over with back in November. It's a lot of stress on the health. I worry for Auntie Carol and the family. You know, it's so draining and exhausting for them. Let alone all the travelling that we've done, had to do across Australia for this campaign for justice for Jalika.
And you mentioned her birthday. I'm guessing she would have been 24, wouldn't she have been, on Boxing Day?
Yeah, well, that's right. It wasn't very... It was a pretty somber day, actually, for many of us on that day. That being said, we're pretty glad that the inquest has recommenced. You know, the sooner it finishes, the sooner we can start our legal battles.
When you talk about the inquest starting, because obviously it's all the police evidence this week, I guess what was the feeling seeing those police in the courtroom on the family's perspective?
Well, it was pretty overwhelming. To say the least, to actually see them finally on the stand was quite satisfying as well, in a way. To finally see and hear these, apparent statements, truths, come from their system, the police officers who were involved. Even though a lot of their replies to cross-examination and to the counsel, assistant counsel, there's still a lot of don't remember and don't recall what happened back in November with the health staff.
Could that be a case of the fact it takes so long for inquests to start, I guess?
That would be a pretty big factor, as well as their unwillingness to want to recall the actual facts of what happened on the day. You know, they can, as with the health staff, on one of the days Jalika was incarcerated and detained, there was a local race day, a horse race meet in Hedland, yet a lot of the nursing staff and health staff there seem to remember very clearly and smile when they state that I don't recall this or that about Jalika, but yeah, I remember clearly it was a racing day that day.
Yeah.
As if to say, yeah, I was at the hospital with dealing with this instead of having my day off at the races. You know, it's just that mentality that is so blatant and deeply ingrained. It's really bold without them even knowing, because it's so deeply ingrained that they don't realise how much it is showing to the rest of the broader community and to the family of the deceased.
Yeah, and you talked about the police. A lot of them have said that Miss Dew obviously complained that she was in a lot of pain, but her pain was just not believed. And one of the police actually said that they thought she was faking it. How do you view this sort of, you know, inability to believe an Aboriginal girl when she was so obviously in pain?
Yeah, well, that's just the ingrained systemic racism, institutional racism in Western Australia is just unbelievable. Mm. And for them to be able to, well, they're quick to say and try and defend themselves and say that they aren't medical staff or doctors or nurses when it comes to sick people in custody, yet it's clearly there in CCTV footage that they were trying to take on the role as a certified medical officer to Jalika in the actual watch house, in the lockup, in the charge room, standing up in front of Jalika while she's sitting down in pain and begging and moaning, standing up in front of her, talking down to her as if she was a damn doctor or nurse, you know.
Is that what the footage showed from your view, the CCTV footage?
Yeah, it did, and the whole courtroom seen it on day one of November when the inquest actually first started way back then. So there's so many things that is on that CCTV footage, all of that footage, be it from the lockup and the health campus, that directly incriminates all officers and health staff involved who are required to take a stand at the inquest and testify their supposed real truth and testimony of what happened.
Was it hard seeing your niece in that footage?
Yes, it's very hard to. It's something that I'll never forget. That will haunt me for the rest of my life, and I'm just an uncle who's doing what he can to try and find justice for his niece and for the other family, and Auntie Carol and Jalika's mother and father and quite close family to actually have to see that as well.
Yeah.
It's just
unbelievable.
Yeah, well, it's unbelievable and so needless and senseless. As with how her death was, so needless and senseless, and could have been prevented on so many levels by so many people. Yet she was neglected on so many levels by them, so many people who were supposedly her supposed government carers. It was their duty of care, and they severely neglected her, as with all other deaths in custody. It's so deeply ingrained, and they know that they will get away with it. They don't even get away with it with a slap on the wrist these days. It's not even that much. That's how the Australian laws are. As with Australia-wide, obviously.
Has there been anything in the inquest that has particularly stood out to you, or maybe shocked you? Things that you didn't know, you were glad to see sort of validated or come out in the open?
Yeah, well, so much that's come out has backed up and proven what we've travelled and campaigned nationwide and globally about to raise awareness about and support about. It's all coming out to prove and actually to shut down all the non-believers and all the all the racist people out there, really, because from day one of Jalika's passing in custody, there has been a barrage of racial comments and everything through social media, and it's been there every day since the 4th of August when Jalika passed away in 2014, and we're a year and a half, 19 months down the track or thereabouts, and it hasn't stopped. It has slowed down, but as I was saying, with the footage and the inquest actually commencing, it's backed our family and our campaign up and proven that we have not been lying.
Yep.
You know, it's proven to the world, not just WA,
yeah.
And not nationwide.
So there's this...
Which is why we got that global support, because the whole world can see just how much neglect, and when Jalika was crying and begging for help in her dying days and hours.
So I guess there's, in some sense, a relief that someone is finally listening to you, or something is finally coming out, even though obviously it's just so traumatic as well.
Yeah, it really is. Sad to say that, but we're happy that these things are coming out. It's one thing that needs to really come out of the inquest, but is footage of the CCTV.
Yeah.
What was recorded, that needs to be put out in public, due to family reasons from both sides of Jalika's family. We had that suppressed on day one back in November until after the inquest was over.
Oh, right.
Because it's quite obvious at some points in that footage that she is actually deceased. So, that being said about the footage as well, we did not know that we were going to have to come back so many months later to finish the inquest. We were hoping, and it was expected to finish back in November. So, in that sense, if it was finished back in November, we should have, the CCTV footage and pieces of it would have been aired through the media and globally already, which would have really drawn a lot more attention on the matter.
So do you think that CCTV footage, obviously you and whoever is in that courtroom is the only one who's seen it, but how do you think Australia would react if they saw that footage of your niece?
I think that'd really be, it'd really be a very rude awakening, and actual eye-opener to the world just on how Black Australia really does still get treated in today's supposed advanced society. You know, Western Australia and Australia are still operating back in the prehistoric ages, and this footage, it will absolutely shock people. It will make people cry, and tears will roll. People will be angry and be shaking in anger as well, and sadness. That is plain and simple what this footage is capable of doing.
Yep.
It has done it to people in the courtroom. It's not just the family who are gasping in the courtroom. It's the media. It's the random people who come in to show their support.
Yeah.
On a daily, day in, day out basis. We have different people coming in every day, just one or two or few who we don't know, who have heard the story and wanted to come in to show their support, for example. That gives us extra strength to keep doing this as well. and that's it. It's not just for Jalika, justice for Jalika. We've been trying from the start to try and enforce custodial reform for all deaths in custody, and not just back deaths in custody either. It's deaths in custody as a whole, because police don't discriminate. Deaths in custody is deaths in custody. Just so happens that we as a minority have way more of a percentage in the prison population, which is just so happens to be amongst the worst race in the world, if not at number one.
Before your niece's death, did you have any sort of understanding of the scale of what was happening in relation to death in custody, particularly in Western Australia?
Yes, I did, actually. Western Australia is pretty... they're pretty used to death in custody. Mm. The police system and the government system here, unaccounted, as history has shown all over Australia. There's so many people dying in mental institutions as well, who are in them institutions through custodial centres and whatnot. So they're in mental institutions under custody, and yet they're not classified as death in custody because they're in mental institutions, yet they are court ordered to be in their mental institutions, which still means that they're in custody. There's one family case back in Geraldton, back at home, that I got told of from one lady. Her father was a death in Geraldton hospital. He was a detainee at the Grenfell prison in Geraldton. He was sick, so they took him into the hospital, and that's where he died. So the government have always said, and the police, that they have not got a case, a death in custody case, because he died in hospital. Mm. That's just, these cases are just all over the place, especially over here. And they're not isolated incidents. They try and say, this is an isolated incident, so you haven't got a case. It wasn't a death in custody, it was in hospital, you haven't got a case. You know, they're all still death in custody. And it's not going to stop because there's no accountability.
Do you think there's a reason why there's been so many death in custodies just recently in Western Australia? There seems to be, over the past few years, just more and more occurring in WA.
Yeah, I think it's because maybe the First Nations people are starting to rise up more now.
So you hear about them?
In recent years. So we're getting more. Well, we're all affected by death in custody as well.
Yeah.
We have memories. I'm 39 this year. I have memories from... I have memories from back when I was 11, marching through streets in Geraldton for death in custody. Everyone's affected by it. Doesn't matter how close or how much we... Especially being black people, it's just a sad fact of Australia.
Yeah.
And their history. And, yeah, as I said, if there's no accountability, they're going to keep doing it because they know they're going to get away with it. And that's just prehistoric mentalities that are still operating in the judicial system and the government system in Western Australia and Australia. And that needs to stop. We're in year 2016. We're not back in the 1600s,
you know. If people want to actually support your campaign and your family, how's the best way to do it? How would they best be able to support you guys?
There are numerous Facebook events that have been put up and run for Jalika. I suppose if you just search Jew on Facebook, some things may come up. So the Death in Custody Watch Committee have supported us majorly throughout a big chunk of this time. They have a Facebook page, the Death in Custody Watch Committee, WA Inc.
Yeah.
And there's Sydney and Melbourne Indigenous Social Justice Association as well. They've supported us as well. They have Facebook pages and they're quite active running events and rallies for death in custody and just normal Indigenous issues as well.
That was the uncle of Miss Jew, Sean Harris, ending that there, talking about how you can support the campaign for justice for his niece, Miss Jew, who died in a South Headland watch house nearly 2 years ago. She was a young 22-year-old woman who tragically lost her life. And as we heard earlier in the program from The Guardian's Carla Walkhurst and human rights lawyer George Newhouse, who were both following the inquest, which recommenced this week and continues over next week. So that'll be one that we'll continue to keep a track of, and we'll keep our listeners updated about. I think it's a very sad, horrific case, really, and I wish it wasn't happening 20 years after the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody, and we still have this situation where too many of our young people are dying in prisons, largely from devastating failures of duty of care, largely because they're Aboriginal. And I think that's a really important point that we have to make, that would Ms. Dew have ended up in the watch house if she wasn't Aboriginal, if she was a non-Indigenous woman? Would it be on the covers of newspapers all around the country if she was a non-Indigenous woman? Would police and would health professionals have thought she was exaggerating her pain, or thought that she was coming down on drugs if she wasn't Aboriginal? I think these are all questions that we have to grapple with as a country. But as George Newhouse was saying, we have to await the findings of the coroner, really, and that'll be a sad long wait yet again. But I really want to send a shout out to the family as well. Their strength and tenacity, as always, has been really amazing and inspiring to watch. And if you want to support them, I'm sure you can go onto Facebook and look up Ms. Dew Inquest, or support the various social justice organisations in your state, particularly Sydney and Melbourne, or look up Death in Custody Watch. That's it for me. It's been a great week back in the studio. I hope everyone has a great day and a great weekend. I'll be back next week for Let's Talk.